It stretched away from Becky. Yeah, she was a Becky, all right. As Becky could be. And around the corner of the lean-to. A moment later, Pete heard a scaly scraping sound as something slithered on the tin roof. He craned up, following the sound with his eyes. "Go away," he whispered. "Go away and leave me alone. I'm fucked up." There was another brief slither as the thing moved farther up the tin. Yes, he was fucked up. Unfortunately, he was also food. The thing up there slithered again. Pete didn't think it would wait long. Maybe couldn't wait long. Not up there. It would be like a gecko in a refrigerator. What it was going to do was drop on him. And now he realized a terrible thing. He had gotten so fixated on the beer that he had forgotten the fucking guns. His first impulse was to crawl deeper into the lean-to, but that might be a mistake, like running into a blind alley. He grabbed the jutting end of one of the fresh branches he had just put on the fire instead. He didn't take it out, not yet, just made a loose fist around it. The other end was burning, briskly. "Come on," he said to the tin roof. "You like it hot? I got something hot for you. Come on and get it, yum fucking yum." Nothing. Not from the roof, anyway. There was a soft flump of snow falling from one of the pines behind him as the lower branches shed their burden. Pete's hand tightened on his makeshift torch, half lifting it from the fire. Then he let it settle back in a little swirl of sparks. "Come on, motherfucker, I'm hot, I'm tasty, and I'm waiting." Nothing. But it was up there. It couldn't wait long, he was sure of it. Soon it would come. Time passed. Pete wasn't sure how much. His watch had given up entirely. Sometimes his thoughts seemed to intensify, as they sometimes had when he and the others were hanging with Duddits, although, as they grew older and Duddits stayed the same, there had been less of that. It was as though their changing brains and bodies had lost the knack of picking up Duddits' strange signals. This was like that, but not exactly like that. Something new, maybe. Maybe even something to do with the lights in the sky. He was aware that Beaver was dead, and that something terrible might have happened to Jonesy, but he didn't know what. Whatever had happened, Pete thought Henry knew about it too, although not clearly. Henry was deep inside his own head, and he thought, "Banbury Cross, Banbury Cross, ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross." The stick burned down further, closer to his hand, and Pete wondered what he'd do if it burned down too far to be of use, if the thing up there could outweigh him after all. And then a new thought came to him, bright as day and red with panic. It filled his head, and he began to cry it aloud, masking the sound of the thing on the roof as it slithered quickly down the slope of the tin. "Please don't hurt us! Ne nous blessez pas!" But they would. They would. Because... what? Because they are not helpless little E.T.'s boys waiting around for someone to give them a New England Tel phone card so they can phone home. They are a disease. They are cancer, praise Jesus. And boys, we're one big, hot, radioactive shot of chemotherapy. Do you hear me, boys? Pete didn't know if they did, the boys to whom the voice spoke, but he did. They were coming. The boys were coming. The Crimson Pirates were coming, and not all the begging in the world would stop them. And still they begged, and Pete begged with them. "Please don't hurt us. Please, s'il vous plaît, ne nous blessez pas. Ne nous faites pas mal. Sommes en défense." Weeping now. "Please, for the love of God, we're helpless." In his mind, he saw the hand, the dog turd, the weeping, nearly naked boy. And all the time, the thing on the roof was slithering, dying, but not helpless. Stupid, but not entirely stupid. Getting behind Pete while he screamed, while he lay on his side by the dead woman, listening as some apocalyptic slaughter began. "Cancer," said the man with the white eyelashes.
Please, Pete screamed. Please, we're helpless.
But, lie or the truth, it was too late. The snowmobile had passed Henry's hiding place without slowing, and the sound of it was now receding to the west. It was safe to come out, but Henry didn't come out, couldn't come out. The intelligence, which had replaced Jonesy, hadn't sensed him, either because it was distracted or because Jonesy had somehow, might somehow still be... But no. The idea that there could be any of Jonesy left inside that terrible cloud was so much dream work. And now that the thing was gone, receding at least, there were the voices. They filled Henry's head, making him feel half mad with their babble, as Duditz's crying had always made him feel half mad, at least until puberty had ended most of that crap. One of the voices belonged to a man who said something about a fungus.
Dies easily unless it gets on a living host.
And then something about a New England telephone card and chemotherapy? Yes, a big hot radioactive shot. It was the voice, Henry thought, of a lunatic. He had treated enough of them to judge, God knew. The other voices were the ones which made him question his own sanity. He didn't know all of them, but he knew some. Walter Cronkite, Bugs Bunny, Jack Webb, Jimmy Carter, a woman he thought was Margaret Thatcher. Sometimes the voices spoke in English, sometimes in French.
Il n'y a pas d'infection ici, Henry said,
and then began to weep. He was astounded and exhilarated to find there were still tears in his heart, from which he thought all tears and all laughter, true laughter, had fled. Tears of horror, tears of pity, tears that opened the stony ground of self-regarding obsession and burst the rock inside.
There is no infection here, please. Oh, God, stop it. Don't. Don't. Nous sommes sans défense. Nous sommes sans...
Then the human thunder began in the west, and Henry put his hands to his head, thinking that the screams and the pain in there would tear it apart. The bastards were... The bastards were slaughtering them. Pete sat by the fire, unmindful of the bellows of pain from his separated knee, unaware that he was now holding the branch from the fire up beside his temple. The screams inside his head could not quite drown out the sound of the machine guns in the west, big machine guns, 50s. Now the cries, "Please don't hurt us. We are defenseless. There is no infection," began to fade into panic. It wasn't working. Nothing could work. The deal was done. Movement caught Pete's eye, and he turned just as the thing that had been on the roof struck at him. He caught a blurred glimpse of a slender, weaselly body that seemed powered by a muscular tail rather than legs, and then its teeth sank into his ankle. He shrieked and yanked his good leg toward him so hard he almost clocked himself in the chin with his own knee. The thing came with it, clinging like a leech. Were these the things that were begging for mercy? Fuck them if they were. Fuck them. He reached for it with his right hand, the one he'd cut on the bud bottle, without even thinking about it. The torch he continued to hold up at the side of his head with his uninjured left. He seized something that felt like cool, fur-covered jelly. The thing let go of his ankle at once, and Pete caught just a glimpse of expressionless black eyes, shark's eyes, eagle eyes, before it sank the needle nest of its teeth into his clutching hand, tearing it wide open along the perforation of the previous cut. The agony was like the end of the world. The thing's head, if it had one, was buried in the hand, ripping and tearing, digging deeper. Blood flew in splattery fans as Pete tried to shake it off, stippling the snow and the sawdusty tarp and the dead woman's parka. Droplets flew into the fire and hissed like fat in a hot skillet. Now the thing was making a ferocious chittering sound. Its tail, as thick as a moray eel's body, wrapped around Pete's thrashing arm, endeavoring to keep it still. Pete made no conscious decision to use the torch, because he'd forgotten he had it. His only thought was to tear the terrible biting thing off his right hand with his left. At first, when it caught fire and flared up as hot and bright as a roll of newspaper, he didn't understand what was happening. Then he screamed, partly in fresh pain, and partly in triumph. He bolted to his feet, for the time being at least his bulging knee did not hurt at all, and swung his burdened right arm at one of the lean-to's support posts in a great sweeping roundhouse. There was a crunch, and the chittering sound was replaced by muffled squealing. For one endless moment, the knot of teeth planted in his hand burrowed in deeper than ever. Then they loosened, and the burning creature fell free and landed on the frozen ground. Pete stamped on it, felt it writhe under his heel, and was filled with one moment of pure and savage triumph before his outraged knee gave way entirely and his leg bent inside out, the tendons torn loose. He fell heavily on his side, face to face with Becky's lethal hitchhiker, unaware that the lean-to was beginning to shift, the pole he'd struck with his arm bowing slowly outward. For a moment, the weasel thing's rudiment of a face was 3 inches from Pete's own. Its burning body flapped against his jacket. Its black eyes boiled. It had nothing so sophisticated as a mouth, but when the bulge in the top of its body unhinged, revealing its teeth, Pete screamed at it, "No! No! No!" and batted it into the fire, where it writhed and made its frantic monkey-like chittering. His left foot swung in a short arc as he shoved the thing further into the fire. The tip of his boot struck the tilting pole, which had just decided to hold the lean-to up a little longer. This was one outrage too many, and the pole snapped, dropping half of the tin roof. A second or two later, the other pole snapped as well. The rest of the roof fell into the fire, sending out a whirling squirt of sparks. For a moment, that was all. Then the fallen sheet of rusty tin began to heave itself up and down as if it were breathing. A moment later, Pete crawled out from under. His eyes were glazed. His skin was pasty with shock. The left cuff of his jacket was on fire. He stared at this for a moment with his legs still under the fallen roof from the knees down, then raised his arm in front of his face, drew a deep breath, and blew out the flames rising from his jacket like a giant birthday candle. Approaching from the east was the buzz of a snowmobile engine. Jonesy, or whatever was left of him. The cloud. Pete didn't think it would show him any mercy. This was no day for mercy in the Jefferson Tract. He should hide, but the voice advising him of that was distant, unimportant. One thing was good. He had an idea. He had finally quit drinking. He raised his savaged right hand in front of his face. One finger was gone, presumably down the thing's gullet. Two others lay in a swoon of severed tendons. He saw that reddish gold stuff already growing along the deepest slashes, the ones the monster had inflicted, and the one he'd done himself, crawling back into the scout after the beer. He could feel a kind of fizzy sensation, as whatever that stuff was fed on his flesh and blood. Pete suddenly felt that he couldn't die soon enough. The sound of the machine guns in the west had stopped, but it wasn't over there, not by a long shot. And, as if the thought had summoned it, a huge explosion hammered the day, blotting out the wasp whine of the oncoming snowmobile and everything else. Everything but the busy fizz in his hand, that was. In his hand, the crud was dining on him the way the cancer that had killed his father had dined on the old man's stomach and lungs. Pete ran his tongue over his teeth, felt gaps where some of them had fallen out. He closed his eyes and waited.
Part 2. Gray Boys. A ghost comes out of the unconscious mind. To grope my sill, it moans to be reborn. The figure at my back is not my friend. The hand upon my shoulder turns to horn. Theodore Ruffke.
Chapter 10. Kurtz and Underhill. The only thing in the ops area was a little beer and deer store called Goslin's Country Market. Kurtz's cleaners began arriving there shortly after the snow began to fall. By the time Kurtz himself got there at 10:30, support was starting to appear. They were getting a grip on the situation. The store was designated Blue Base. The barn, the adjacent stable, dilapidated but still standing, and the corral had been designated Blue Holding. The first detainees had already been deposited there. Archie Perlmutter, Kurtz's new aide-de-camp, his old one, Calvert, had died of a heart attack not 2 weeks before. Goddamn bad timing. Had a clipboard with a dozen names on it. Perlmutter had arrived with both a laptop computer and a Palm Pilot, only to discover that electronic gear was currently FUBAR in the Jefferson Tract, fucked up beyond all recognition. The top two names on the clipboard were Goslin's, the old man who ran the store, and his wife. "More on the way," Perlmutter said. Kurtz gave the names on Pearlie's clipboard a cursory look, then handed it back. Big recreational vehicles were being parked behind them. Semi-trailers were being jacked and leveled. Light poles were going up. When night came, this place would be as well lighted as Yankee Stadium at World Series time. "We missed two guys by this much," Perlmutter said, and held up his right hand with the thumb and forefinger a quarter of an inch apart. "They came in for supplies, principally beer and hot dogs." Perlmutter's face was pale, with a wild pink rose blooming in each cheek. He had to raise his voice against the steadily increasing noise level. Helicopters were coming in two by two and landing on the blacktop lane that eventually made its way out to Interstate 95, where you could go north toward one dull town, Presque Isle, or south toward any number of other dull towns, Bangor and Derry for starters. The helicopters were fine, as long as their pilots didn't have to depend on all the sophisticated navigational equipment, which was also FUBAR. "Did those fellas go in or out?" Kurtz asked. "Back in," Perlmutter said. He could not quite bring himself to meet Kurtz's eyes. He looked everywhere but. "There's a woods road. Goslin said it's called the Deep Cut Road. It's not on the standard maps, but I have a Diamond International Paper survey map that shows..." "That's fine. Either they'll come back out or stay in. Either way, it's fine." More helicopters, some unshipping their 50s now that they were safely away from the wrong eyes. This could end up being as big as Desert Storm. Maybe bigger. "You understand your mission here, Pearlie, don't you?" Perlmutter most definitely did. He was new. He wanted to make an impression. He was almost jumping up and down. Like a spaniel that smells lunch, Kurtz thought. And he did it all without making eye contact. "Sir, my job is triune in nature." Triune, Kurtz thought. Triune, how about that? "I am to A, intercept, B, turn intercepted persons over to medical, and C, contain and segregate pending further orders." "Exactly. That's..." "But sir, beg your pardon, sir, but we don't have any doctors here yet, only a few corpsmen, and..." "Shut up," Kurtz said. He didn't speak loudly, but half a dozen men in unmarked green coveralls, they were all wearing unmarked green coveralls, including Kurtz himself, hesitated as they went double-timing on their various errands. They glanced toward where Kurtz and Perlmutter were standing, then got moving again, triple time. As for Perlmutter, the roses in his cheeks died at once. He stepped back, putting another foot between himself and Kurtz. "If you ever interrupt me again, Pearlie, I'll knock you down. Interrupt me a second time and I'll put you in a hospital. Do you understand?" With what was clearly a tremendous effort, Perlmutter brought his gaze up to Kurtz's face, to Kurtz's eyes. He snapped off a salute so crisp it almost crackled with static electricity. "Sir, yes, sir!" "You can quit that, too. You know better." And when Perlmutter's gaze began to drop, "Look at me when I'm talking to you, laddie." Very reluctantly, Perlmutter did so. His complexion was now leaden. Although the noise of the helicopters lined up along the road was cacophonous, it somehow seemed very quiet right here, as if Kurtz traveled in his own weird air pocket. Perlmutter was convinced that everyone was watching them, and that they could all see how terrified he was. Some of it was his new boss's eyes, the cataclysmic absence in those eyes, as if there were really no brain behind them at all. Perlmutter had heard of the thousand-yard stare, but Kurtz's seemed to go on for a million yards, maybe light years. Yet, somehow, Perlmutter held Kurtz's gaze, looked it into the absence. He was not off to a good start here. It was important, it was imperative, that the slide be stopped before it could become an avalanche. All right. Good. Better, anyway. Kurtz's voice was low, but Perlmutter had no problem hearing him, despite the overlapping chunter of the helicopters.
I'm going to say this to you just once, and only because you're new to my service, and you clearly don't know your asshole from your pie hole. I have been asked to run a puka operation here. Do you know what a puka is?
No, Perlmutter said.
It caused him almost physical pain not to be able to say, no, sir. According to the Irish, who as a race have never entirely crawled from the bath of superstition in which their mothers gat them, a puka is a phantom horse that kidnaps travelers and carries them away on its back. I use it to mean an operation which is both covert and wide open. A paradox, Perlmutter. The good news is that we've been developing contingency plans for just this sort of clusterfuck since 1947, when the Air Force first recovered the sort of extraterrestrial artifact now known as a flashlight. The bad news is that the future is now, and I have to face it with guys like you in support. Do you understand me, Buck?
Yes, sir. Yes.
I hope so. What we've got to do here, Perlmutter, is go in fast and hard and utterly puka. We're going to do as much dirty work as we have to and come out as clean as we can. Clean, yes, Lord, and smiling.
Kurtz bared his teeth in a brief smile of such brutally satiric intensity that Perlmutter felt a little like screaming. Tall and stoop-shouldered, Kurtz had the build of a bureaucrat. Yet something about him was terrible. You saw some of it in his eyes, sensed some of it in the still, prim way he held his hands in front of him. But those weren't the things that made him scary, that made the men call him old creepy Kurtz. Perlmutter didn't know exactly what the real scary thing was, and didn't want to know. What he wanted right now, the only thing he wanted, was to get out of this conversation with his ass on straight. Who needed to go 20 or 30 miles west to make contact with an alien species? Perlmutter had one standing right here in front of him. Kurtz's lips snapped shut over his teeth.
On the same page, are we?
Yes.
Saluting the same flag, pissing in the same latrine?
Yes.
How are we going to come out of this, Pearly?
Clean?
Buffo. And how else?
For one horrible second, he didn't know. Then it came to him.
Smiling, sir! Call me sir again, and I'll knock you down.
I'm sorry, Perlmutter whispered.
He was, too.
Here came a school bus rolling slowly up the road, with its offside wheels in the ditch, and canted almost to the tip-over point so it could get past the helicopters. Millinocket School Department was written up the side, big black letters against a yellow background. Commandeered bus. Owen Underhill and his men inside. The A-team. Perlmutter saw it and felt better. At different times, both men had worked with Underhill.
You'll have doctors by nightfall, Kurtz said. All the doctors you need.
Check. Check. As he walked toward the bus, which stopped in front of Goslin's single gasoline pump, Kurtz looked at his pocket watch. Almost 11.
Gosh, how the time flew when you were having fun.
Perlmutter walked with him, but all the cocker spaniel spring had gone out of Perlmutter's step.
For now, Archie, eyeball 'em, smell 'em, listen to their tall tales, and document any Ripley you see. You know about the Ripley, I assume?
Yes.
Good. Don't touch it.
God, no, Perlmutter exclaimed, then flushed. Kurtz smiled thinly. This one was no more real than his shark's grin.
Excellent idea, Perlmutter. You have breathing masks?
They just arrived, 12 cartons of them, and more on the...
Good. We want Polaroids of the Ripley. We need mucho documentation, Exhibit A, Exhibit B, and so on and so forth. Got it?
Yes.
And none of our guests get away, right?
Absolutely not. Perlmutter was shocked by the idea and looked it. Kurtz's lips stretched. The thin smile grew and once more became the shark's grin. Those empty eyes looked through Perlmutter, looked all the way to the center of the earth for all Perlmutter knew. He found himself wondering if anyone would leave Blue Base when this was over. Except Kurtz, that was.
Carry on, Citizen Perlmutter, in the name of the government, I order you to carry on.
Archie Perlmutter watched Kurtz continue on toward the bus, where Underhill, a squat jug of a man, was climbing off. Never in his life had he been so utterly delighted to see a man's back.
Hello, boss, Underhill said. Like the rest, he wore a plain green coverall, but like Kurtz, he also wore a sidearm. Sitting in the bus were roughly 24 men, most of them just finishing an early lunch.
What have they got there, Buck? Kurtz asked.
At 6'6", he towered above Underhill, but Underhill probably outweighed him by 70 pounds.
Burger King. We drove through. I didn't think the bus would fit, but Yoder said it would, and he was right.
Want a Whopper? I'm probably a little on the cold side by now, but there must be a microwave in there someplace.
Underhill nodded toward the store.
I'll pass. Cholesterol's not so good these days.
Groin okay?
6 years before, Kurtz had suffered a serious groin pull while playing racquetball. This had indirectly led to their only disagreement. Not a serious one, Owen Underhill judged, but with Kurtz, it was hard to tell. Behind the man's patented game face, thoughts came and went at near lightning speed, agendas were constantly being rewritten, and emotions were turning on a dime. There were people, quite a few of them actually, who thought Kurtz was crazy. Owen Underhill didn't know if he was or not, but he knew you wanted to be careful around this one. Very.
As the Irish might put it, Kurtz said, me groin's fine.
He reached between his legs, gave his balls a burlesque yank, and favored Owen with that teeth-bearing grin.
Good.
And you, been okay?
Me groin's fine, Owen said, and Kurtz laughed.
Now coming up the road, rolling slowly and carefully, but having an easier time than the bus, was a brand new Lincoln Navigator with three orange-clad hunters inside, hefty boys all three, gawking at the helicopters and the double-timing soldiers in their green coveralls, gawking at the guns mostly. Vietnam comes to northern Maine, praise God. Soon they would join the others in the holding area. Half a dozen men approached as the Navigator pulled up behind the bus, with its stickers reading Blue Devil Pride and This Vehicle Stops at All RR Crossings. Three lawyers or bankers with their own cholesterol problems and fat stock portfolios, lawyers or bankers pretending to be good old boys, under the impression, of which they would soon be disabused, that they were still in an America at peace. Soon they would be in the barn, or the corral if they craved fresh air, where their visa cards would not be honored. They would be allowed to keep their cell phones. They wouldn't work this far up in the willy-wags, but hitting redial might keep them amused.
You plugged in tight? Kurtz asked.
I think so, yes.
Still a quick study?
Owen shrugged.
How many people in the blue zone altogether, Owen?
We estimate 800. No more than 100 in zones prime A and prime B.
That was good, assuming no one slipped through. In terms of possible contamination, a few slips wouldn't matter. The news, at least so far, was good on that score. In terms of information management, however, it would not be good at all. It was hard to ride a puka horse these days. Too many people with video cams, too many TV station helicopters, too many watching eyes.
Kurtz said, come inside the store. They're setting me up a bago, but it's not here yet.
Un momento, Underhill said, and dashed up the steps of the bus. When he came back down, he had a grease-spotted Burger King sack in his hand and a tape recorder over his shoulder on a strap. Kurtz nodded toward the bag.
That stuff will kill you.
We're starring in the War of the Worlds and you're worried about high cholesterol?
Behind them, one of the newly arrived mighty hunters was saying he wanted to call his lawyer, which probably meant he was a banker. Kurtz led Underhill into the store. Above them, the flashlights were back, running their glow over the bottoms of the clouds, jumping and dancing like animated characters in a Disney cartoon. Old man Goslin's office smelled of salami, cigars, beer, mustard oil, and sulfur. Either farts or boiled eggs, Kurtz reckoned. Maybe both. There was also a smell, faint but discernible, of ethyl alcohol. The smell of them. It was everywhere up here now. Another man might have been tempted to ascribe that smell to a combination of nerves and too much imagination, but Kurtz
had never been overburdened with either. In any case, he did not believe the 100 or so square miles of forest land surrounding Goslin's country market had much future as a viable ecosystem. Sometimes, he just had to sand a piece of furniture down to the bare wood and start again. Kurtz sat behind the desk and opened one of the drawers. A cardboard box with Chem U.S. 10 units stamped on it lay within. Good for Perlmutter. Kurtz took it out and opened it. Inside were a number of small plastic masks, the transparent sort that fitted over the mouth and nose. He tossed one to Underhill and then put one on himself, quickly adjusting the elastic straps.
"Are these necessary?" Owen asked.
"We don't know, and don't feel privileged. In another hour, everyone is going to be wearing them. Except for the John Q's in the holding area, that is."
Underhill donned his mask and adjusted the straps without further comment. Kurtz sat behind the desk with his head leaning back against the latest piece of OSHA paperwork, post-it or die, taped to the wall behind him.
"Do they work?"
Underhill's voice was hardly muffled at all. The clear plastic did not fog with his breathing. It seemed to have no pores or filters, but he found he could breathe easily enough.
"They work on Ebola, they work on anthrax, they work on the new super cholera. Do they work on Ripley?"
"Probably.
If not, we're fucked, soldier. In fact, we may be fucked already. But the clock is running, and the game is on. Should I hear the tape you've doubtless gotten that thing over your shoulder?"
"There's no need for you to hear all of it, but you ought to taste, I think."
Kurtz nodded, made a spinning motion in the air with his forefinger, like an ump signaling a home run, Owen thought, and leaned back further in Goslin's chair. Underhill unslung the tape recorder, set it on the desk facing Kurtz, and pushed play. A toneless robot voice said, "NSA radio intercept, multiband, 62914A44. This material is classified top secret. Time of intercept 0627, November 14, 2001. Intercept recording begins after the tone. If you are not rated security clearance 1, please press stop now."
"Please," Kurtz said, nodding. "Good. That'd stop most unauthorized personnel, don't you think?"
There was a pause, a 2-second beep. Then a young woman's voice said, "1, 2, 3. Please don't hurt us. Ne nous blessez pas." A 2-second silence. Then a young man's voice said, 5, 7, 11. We are helpless. Nous sommes sans défense. Please don't hurt us. We are helpless. Ne nous faites...
"By God, it's like a Berlitz language lesson from the great beyond," Kurtz said.
"Recognize the voices?" Underhill asked. Kurtz shook his head and put a finger to his lips. The next voice was Bill Clinton's.
13, 17, 19. In Clinton's Arkansas accent, the last one came out 19. "There is no infection here. Il n'y a pas d'infection ici."
Another 2-second pause, and then Tom Brokaw spoke from the tape recorder.
23, 27, 29. "We are dying. On se meurt. On crève. We are dying."
Underhill pushed stop. In case you wondered, the first voice is Sarah Jessica Parker, an actress. The second is Brad Pitt.
"Who's he?"
"An actor."
"Uh-huh."
Each pause is followed by another voice. All the voices are or would be recognizable to large segments of the people in this area. There's Alfred Hitchcock, Paul Harvey, Garth Brooks, Tim Sample. He's a Maine-style humorist, very popular. And hundreds of others, some of which we haven't identified.
Hundreds of others? How long did this intercept last?
Strictly speaking, it's not an intercept at all, but a clear band transmission, which we've been jamming since 0800. Which means a bunch of it got out, but we doubt if anyone who picked it up will have understood much of it. And if they do... Underhill gave a little what-can-you-do shrug. "It's still going on. The voices appear to be real. The few voice print comparisons that were run are identical. Whatever else they are, these guys could put Rich Little out of business." The whoop-whoop-whoop of the helicopters came clearly through the walls. Kurtz could feel it as well as hear it. Through the boards, through the OSHA poster, and from there into the gray meat that was mostly water, telling him to come on, come on, come on, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up.
His blood responded to it, but he sat quietly looking at Owen Underhill, thinking about Owen Underhill. Make haste slowly. That was a useful saying, especially when dealing with folks like Owen. How's your groin indeed? You fucked with me once, Buck, Kurtz thought. Maybe didn't cross my line, but by God, you scuffed at it, didn't you? Yes, I think so, and I think you'll bear watching. Same four messages over and over, Underhill said, and then ticked them off the fingers of his left hand. Don't hurt us. We're helpless. There's no infection here. The last one, no infection, Kurtz mused. They've got their nerve, don't they? He had seen pictures of the reddish-gold fuzz growing on all the trees around Blue Boy, and on people, corpses mostly, at least so far. The Tex had named it Ripley fungus, after the tough broad Sigourney Weaver had played in those space movies. Most of them were too young to remember the other Ripley, who had done the Believe It or Not feature in the newspapers. Believe It or Not was pretty much gone now, too freaky for the politically correct 21st century. But it fit this situation, Kurtz thought. Oh, yes, like a glove. Made old Mr. Ripley's Siamese twins and two-headed cows look positively normal by comparison. The last one is We're Dying, Underhill said. That one's interesting because of the two different French versions accompanying the English. The first is straightforward. The second, En Crevé, is slangy. We might say, our goose is cooked. He looked directly at Kurtz, who wished Perlmutter were here to see that, yes, it could be done. Are they cooked? I mean, assuming we don't help them along? Why French, Owen? Underhill shrugged. It's still the other language up here. Ah, and the prime numbers, just to show us we're dealing with intelligent beings? As if any other kind could travel here from another star system or dimension or wherever it is they come from? I guess so. What about the flashlights, boss? Most are now down in the woods. They disintegrate fairly rapidly once they run out of juice. The ones we've been able to retrieve look like soup cans with the labels stripped off. Considering their size, they put on a hell of a show, don't they? Scared the living hell out of the locals. When the flashlights disintegrated, they left patches of the fungus or ergo or whatever the hell it was behind. The same seemed true of the aliens themselves. The ones that were left were just up there standing around their ship like commuters standing around a broken-down bus, bawling that they weren't infectious. Il n'y a pas d'infection ici. Praise the Lord and pass the biscuits. And once the stuff was on you, you were, most likely, what had Owen said? A cooked goose. They didn't know that for sure, of course. It was early yet, but they had to make the assumption. How many ETs still up there, Owen asked. Maybe 100. How much don't we know? Does anybody have any idea? Kurtz waved this aside. He was not a knower. Knowing was someone else's department, and none of those guys had been invited to this particular pre-Thanksgiving party. The survivors, Underhill persisted. Are they crew? Don't know, but probably not. Too many for crew, not enough to be colonists, nowhere near enough to be shock troops. What else is going on up here, boss? Something is. Pretty sure of that, are you? Yes. Why? Underhill shrugged. Intuition? It's not intuition, Kurtz said almost gently. It's telepathy. Say what? Low grade, but there's really not any question about it. The men sense something, but they haven't put a name on it yet. Give them a few hours and they will. Our gray friends are telepaths, and they seem to spread that just as they spread the fungus. Holy fucking shit. Owen Underhill whispered. Kurtz sat calmly watching him think. He liked watching people think, if they were any good at it. And now there was more. He was hearing Owen think. A faint sound, like the ocean in a conch shell. The fungus isn't strong in the environment, Owen said. Neither are they. What about the ESP? Too soon to tell. If it lasts, though, and if it gets out of this pine tree piss pot we're in, everything changes. You know that, don't you? Underhill knew. I can't believe it, he said. I'm thinking of a car, Kurtz said. What car am I thinking of? Owen looked at him, apparently trying to decide if Kurtz was serious. He saw that Kurtz was, then shook his head.
How should I... He paused. Fiat.
Ferrari, actually. I'm thinking of an ice cream flavor. Which
Pistachio, Owen said. There you go.
Owen sat another moment, then asked Kurtz, hesitantly, if Kurtz could tell him his brother's name.
Kellogg,
Kurtz replied.
Jesus, Owen, what kind of a name is that for a kid?
My mother's maiden name. Christ, telepathy.
It's going to fuck with the ratings of Jeopardy and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, I can tell you that,
Kurtz said, and then repeated. If it gets loose. From outside the building, there came a gunshot and a scream.
You didn't have to do that, someone cried in a voice filled with outrage and fear. You didn't have to do that.
They waited, but there was no more.
The confirmed Gray Boy body count is 81, Kurtz said. There are probably more. Once they go down, they decompose pretty fast. Nothing left but goo, and then the fungus.
Throughout the zone? Kurtz shook his head.
Think of a wedge pointing east. The thick end is Blue Boy. Where we are is at about the middle of the wedge. There are a few more illegal immigrants of the gray persuasion wandering around east of here. The flashlights have mostly stayed over the wedge area. E.T. Highway Patrol.
It's all toast, isn't it? Owen asked. Not just the gray boys and the ship and the flashlights, the whole fucking geography.
I'm not prepared to speak to that just now, Kurtz said.
No, Owen thought. Of course you're not.
He wondered immediately if Kurtz could read his thought. There was no way of telling, certainly not from those pale eyes.
We are going to take out the rest of the gray boys, I can tell you that much. Your men will crew the gunships, and your men only. You are Blue Boy leader, got that?
Yes, sir.
Kurtz did not correct it. In this context, and given Underhill's obvious distaste for the mission, sir was probably good.
I am Blue One, Owen nodded.
Kurtz drew out his pocket watch. It had gone noon.
This is going to get out, Underhill said. There are a lot of U.S. citizens in the zone. There's simply no way to keep it quiet.
How many have those implants?
Kurtz almost smiled. The weasels, yes. A good many here, a few more over the years.
Underhill didn't know, but Kurtz did.
Nasty little fellows they were. And one good thing about being the boss, you didn't have to answer questions you didn't want to answer.
What happens later is up to the spin doctors, he said. Our job is to react to what certain people, the voice of one of them is probably on your tape, have determined is a clear and present danger to the people of the United States. Got it, Buck?
Underhill looked into that pale gaze and at last looked away.
One other thing, Kurtz said. Do you remember the Pooka?
The Irish ghost horse.
Close enough.
When it comes to nags, that one's mine. Always has been. Some folks in Bosnia saw you riding my Pooka, didn't they?
Owen chanced no reply. Kurtz didn't look put out by that, but he looked intent.
I want no repeat, Owen.
Silence is golden. When we ride the Pooka horse, we must be invisible. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Perfect understanding?
Yes, Owen said. He wondered again how much of his mind Kurtz could read. Certainly he could read the name currently in the front of Kurtz's mind, and supposed Kurtz wanted him to. Bozinski Novy. They were on the verge of going. Four gunship crews with Owen Underhill's men from the bus replacing the ANG guys who had brought the CH-47s this far. They were cranking up, filling the air with the thunder of the rotors, and then came Kurtz's order to stand down. Owen passed it on, then flicked his chin to the left. He was now on Kurtz's private comm channel.
Beg pardon, but what the fuck? Owen asked.
If they were going to do this thing, he wanted to do it and get it behind him. It was worse than Bozinski Novy, worse by far. Writing it off by saying the gray boys weren't human beings just did not wash. Not for him, anyway. Beings that could build something like Blue Boy, or fly it at least, were more than human.
It's none of mine, lad, Kurtz said. The weather boys in Bangor say this shit is moving out fast. It's what they call an Alberta clipper. 30 minutes, 45 max, and we're on our way.
With our nav gear all screwed up, it's better to wait if we can, and we can. You'll thank me at the other end.
Man, I doubt that.
Roger, copy.
He flicked his head to the right. Conklin, he said. No rank designations to be used on this mission, especially not on the radio.
I'm here. Tell the men we're on hold 30 to 45. Say again, 30 to 45.
Roger that, 30 to 45. Let's have some jukebox rhythm.
Okay. Requests?
Go with what you like. Just save the squad anthem.
Roger, squad anthem is racked back.